Besides the price tag, much of the recent discussion about a health care overhaul has focused on the differences between the House and Senate bills. But the bills actually have much in common, big ideas that may have once seemed controversial, but are now overshadowed by disagreements over a public option and abortion. We've asked NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner to lay out where the bills agree and how that might change health care for the average American. Julie, hi.
Hi, Melissa.
And let's talk first about people who already have health insurance. What do these bills have in common?
Well, for everyone who has insurance, there is a real emphasis on not letting insurance companies do some of the things that really bother people. So no more could they cap the amount that people could get in annual benefits or in lifetime benefits so that you can't say the insurance would only cover $1 million over your lifetime. There would be bans on pre-existing condition exclusions. This is a big deal for both Republicans and Democrats. There would be bans on something called rescission, so insurers could not come back at you later and say, you forgot to declare that you had were treated for acne when you were 18, so we're going to cancel your insurance. Mm-hmm. Insurers would no longer be able to charge women more than men because women use more health care. Young adults would be allowed to stay on their parents' policies after they graduate college. In the Senate bill, they can stay until they're age 26. In the House, it's age 27.
And for people, Julie, who do not have health insurance now?
Well, obviously, that is the heart of these proposals. In both bills, millions more low-income people would become eligible for the Medicaid program. That's significant because for the first time, you could qualify for Medicaid solely on the basis of having a low income. Right now, you have to have a low income and be something else, either a child or a pregnant woman or disabled or fit into some other category. Now, for people with slightly higher incomes, both bills would create new marketplaces called insurance exchanges. They'd be open to individuals who are self-employed or unemployed or don't get insurance at work, and also to small businesses. There'd be a choice of plans. One of those choices would be a government-run public option. Of course, in the Senate bill, states could opt out of offering that public option if they want to, and there's no guarantee that even that weakened form of public option will pass the Senate, but for now, it's still in there.
And in both bills, Julie, what do they say about requirements for individuals and businesses?
Well, to back up just a little bit, the only way you can require insurance companies to stop discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions is to make sure that people can't wait until they get sick to buy insurance. So that means everyone has to be covered. So both bills have what's called an individual mandate, requiring everyone who doesn't get insurance at work to buy it. And of course, there'll be government subsidies to help people afford that insurance in both bills for families earning up to about $88,000. That's four times the poverty level. Both bills also require some sort of employer participation, but only the House bill actually has an employer mandate. The Senate bill has a more complicated mechanism where businesses don't have to offer insurance, but if their workers end up buying their own insurance and getting the government help, the employers would basically have to pay back the government. Now, I should add that in both bills, small businesses would not have to buy insurance for their workers, but they would get access to better rates than they have now because of these new exchanges, and they would get tax credits to help them. So if small businesses want to help buy insurance for their workers, which many do, it would be much cheaper.
Now, Julie, we just heard from Doug Elmendorf talking about costs of health care overhaul to the government. What do we know about how the bills stack up in terms of how much this will cost families?
Well, we don't know exact dollar amounts, of course, but we do know there will be limits on what people can be required to spend on premiums. For example, low-income people who earn too much to qualify for Medicaid won't have to spend more than 2% of their income on premiums. People at roughly four times poverty, those are the families earning $88,000 we talked about, won't have to spend more than about 10% of their incomes on premiums. But I should point out that one of the places where the bills do diverge significantly is what you get for those premiums. In the House bill, the benefit package is much more generous, so you'd pay less in deductibles and copayments. You'd basically get more for your money. The Senate bill provides considerably less in the way of benefits. That's a big reason why the Senate bill costs so much less than the House bill overall. A lot of health economists and advocates worry that if the Senate bill structure ultimately prevails, there might be a backlash from people who won't think the coverage that they have to buy is worth that money.
Okay, Julie, thanks.
You're welcome.
It's NPR's health policy correspondent, Julie Rovner.
The maverick screenwriter and director Sam Fuller, who died in 1997, influenced filmmakers as different as Jean-Luc Godard, Wim Wenders, and Quentin Tarantino. Martin Scorsese said of his work, "If you don't like the films of Sam Fuller, then you just don't like cinema." A new 7-disc selection of his work, the Sam Fuller Collection, has just been released by Sony Pictures. Our critic at large, John Powers, says Fuller's work embodies what's most enjoyable and enduring about pulp fiction.
There's a famous scene in Jean-Luc Godard's film, Pierrot Le Fou, when the hero meets a big-shot American movie director and asks him to define cinema. The director replies, "Film is like a battleground. Love, hate, action, violence, death. In one word, emotion." The man saying and clearly meaning those words was Samuel Fuller, one of the most colorful characters in movie history. Born in 1912, Fuller was a crime reporter at age 17 and became a pulp novelist and screenwriter in his 20s. By 37, he'd become a Hollywood director who told tales of soldiers and crooks, lunatics and cops, hookers and Wild West outlaws. In the process, he revealed himself to be a distinctively American figure, the seeming barbarian who proves to be an artist. Although Fuller is now an icon, renowned for his raspy voice and cigars the size of billy clubs, much of his work has been hard to find on home video. That's one reason I was so happy to see the Samuel Fuller Collection, which brings 7 movies to DVD. The earliest 5 were written or co-written by Fuller, and like all his work, they're bursting with extreme situations. A parole officer falling for a murderess, or a tabloid editor who kills his ex-wife only to have his star reporter try to solve the crime. Although none of these movies is great, they're all very entertaining. And the 2 pictures directed by Fuller are more than that. The better of the two is Underworld USA, a grippingly unsentimental revenge story from 1961, starring Cliff Robertson as a hood who monomaniacally devotes his whole life to avenging the murder of his father. But I'm personally fonder of The Crimson Kimono, a 1959 crime drama that begins in spectacular fashion with a stripper running down a gaudy neon-lit street, only to be gunned down. Her murder is investigated by 2 L.A. cops, one Caucasian, played by Glenn Corbett, and one Japanese-American. That's James Shigeta in a wonderful performance. Good buddies, they both fall for the same woman, Chris, played by Victoria Shaw. And suddenly, the Crimson Kimono becomes something unexpected, a sharp-eyed look at subterranean racism and the complexities of Asian-American identity. Here, Shigeta's character talks to Chris about his horror at seeing racist feelings on his partner's face for the very first time.
"You can't feel for me unless you are me. Take a good look, Chris. Do I look different to you than I did yesterday?
Joe,
did my face change?
Don't say that.
I've got to say it. I never felt this in the army and the police. Maybe it's 5,000 years of blood behind me busting to the front. For the first time, I feel different. I taste it right through every bone inside me. For the first time, I catch myself trying to figure out who I am. I was born here. I'm American. I feel it and live it and love it, but down deep, what am I? Japanese-American, American-Japanese, Nisei. What label do I live under, Chris? You tell me."
Fuller cut his teeth on the tabloids, their speed, their passion, their pop. And he brought those same qualities to his movies. This was not a man hobbled by subtlety. His dialogue was overripe, his storylines cartoonish, his actors often coarse. Godard once called Fuller's technique cinema fist, and it really is in your face, whether it's one of his eye-popping traveling shots or a close-up so potently huge it's like a bird smacking into your windshield. And he used his style to put across stories unlike anyone else's, weird goulashes of a right-wing fantasy, morality tale, liberal propaganda, vigilante violence, and anti-war sentiment. Like a pulp Dostoevsky, he created characters who were driven, conflicted, extravagant, sometimes even sociopathic. Because his films really were battlegrounds, they were first admired more in Europe, which has always had a condescending fondness for American primitives. Here, his B-movie sensibility was long reckoned unrespectable, although it allowed him to explore things that Hollywood did not. The psychopathy of seeming heroes in fixed bayonets, the absurdity of even good wars in The Big Red One, the dangers of American power in China Gate, and the inescapable corruptions of authority in all of them. That's one reason why Fuller's work still seems utterly alive, while so many Oscar winners now seem dull, old-fashioned, and laughably couth. In fact, the real lesson of Fuller's career is that, in popular culture, visceral power trumps good taste or artistic nicety. That's why I can imagine him digging the crime novels of James Ellroy, or the new movie Precious, which is in many ways exploitative, It's at once manipulative and preachy, degraded and inspirational, yet keeps you riveted and stays in your head. You see, when it came to movies, Fuller really did believe that old line from William Blake: "The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom."
John Powers is film critic at Vogue. You can read his blog, Absolute Powers, at Vogue.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.
When seniors at Lincoln University graduate next spring, as many as 24 could be banned from taking part in the ceremonies. The historically black college in Oxford, Pennsylvania, says it will withhold diplomas from obese students who fail to meet a new requirement for all undergraduates. The school requires any student with a body mass index of 30 or higher to take a Fitness for Life health and nutrition class. The enforcement of that requirement has caused an uproar on campus. The university so far has stood firm, insisting that the measure sends an important message about battling obesity in black America. James DuBois is chair of the Department of Health, Physical Education, and Recreation at Lincoln University. He says the university has an obligation to promote healthy lifestyles on campus.
We know that obesity and its comorbidities are going to rob individuals of quality and quantity of life. What good is it to go through college, get your bachelor's degree at Lincoln University, go get your graduate degree, work for 5, 6, 7 years, and all of a sudden you experience a catastrophic health issue associated with the obesity? That would be a tragedy. So we again believe that it's just our professional educators' responsibility to alert students to this.
A lot of people on campus, even members of the faculty, say the school has completely overstepped its bounds here. They say that this is discrimination, pure and simple, and it seems like they have a point.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me back up a little bit. Colleges test. They assess. A test, by definition, does discriminate. It separates out a particular attribute. If we choose not to do this, what is the solution? If people can say, what you're doing at Lincoln University is wrong, it's mean-spirited, it's evil, okay? That is not addressing the problem. The faculty said that this is that important that we're going to take the hits, we're going to take the criticism, but we have to stand tall. Tell it like it is. Are we going to be criticized? Absolutely. But we have to do what is right.
Now, some of the students say that the university is culpable in some way here. They point to the food that's served, for instance, in the dining hall, and they say that the university does not always offer the healthiest of choices when it comes to the menu.
Right.
Do you bear some responsibility for the people who've put on a few extra pounds while they've been at school?
Certainly, it's a question of what's the opportunity as far as foods. And Lincoln, again, as an HBCU,
it's an isolated campus.
It's isolated, that's true. Lincoln as an HBCU is underfunded. All HBCUs, as far as I know, in my 35 years here at Lincoln, have been historically underfunded. How do you keep costs in line? Unfortunately, one way to cut is that you have food that is going to probably be less costly. Healthy foods cost more. That's a reality.
It sounds like you're saying the university does bear some responsibility here.
We are who we are. We live where we live. Yes, there are certain things that you cannot control, absolutely, but some of the things you can, and they're the ones we're trying to embark upon as far as changing.
So just to go back to those 24 seniors who might not be able to march across that stage at the graduation ceremony, do they still have time to enroll in this class?
Absolutely.
If they just started showing up, they'd be able to graduate.
Absolutely. The course is offered in January. We're finishing up our fall semester in 2 weeks. The classes begin in early January. And we will get those seniors in those HPR 103 classes by hook or by crook. And the opportunity is there for them to take it. And they complete that course, it's not a problem.
Well, yeah. Dr. DuBois, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much, Michelle.
James DuBois is the chair and professor of the Department of Health, Physical Education, and Recreation at Lincoln University in Oxford, Pennsylvania. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Finally, last week's new recommendations on breast cancer screening continue to resonate. A government-appointed panel of independent experts suggested that women hold off getting regular mammograms until age 50. Yesterday, we heard Cindy Pearson of the National Women's Health Network explain why her group welcomes these new guidelines. Pearson says mammograms just aren't that effective for younger women. But for some breast cancer survivors, that's hard to accept. Journalist Renee Seiler says the debate over whether to screen is a very personal one.
I recently met Stephanie Spielman, a wife, a mother, and breast cancer patient, battling for the fifth time. She was very frail, with a warm smile and what could best be described as a peach fuzz-like mullet where her hair was just starting to grow again. Ironically, we met during Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I thought about Stephanie and so many others last week when the U.S. Prevention Task Force announced its revamped mammography guidelines. Among their recommendations, that most women in their 40s do not need routine screening, and in their 50s, a mammogram every other year is sufficient. Why? Because in women 40 to 49, only one in every 1,900 mammograms found breast cancer, along with a high rate of false positives, results that would necessitate further tests and possible surgery. That number was 1 in 1,300 for women 50 and older. The task force said it was also trying to alleviate the anxiety of a false positive. How about the really horrible anxiety of finding a late-stage breast cancer, one that could have been detected earlier and with better prognosis on a mammogram? The task force said these recommendations are for women of average risk, not for women like me. See, my mother and father both had breast cancer, and that, coupled with multiple biopsies and my own breast disease, ultimately led me to choose a preventive mastectomy in 2007. Family history is a big risk factor, but it only counts for about 10 to 15% of breast cancer cases. The rest come right out of the blue in women of average risk. So that's why I cannot fathom telling doctors not to teach women breast self-exam, which is exactly what the task force did. Aren't we supposed to know our own bodies, what looks wrong, feels wrong? We're supposed to know our cholesterol number, blood pressure reading. Why would we not want to know what our breasts feel like? A breast self-exam is free, it's easy, and what's the harm? Tell women like Stephanie, who found her own lump in the shower, that it's pointless. She was 30 years old and pregnant at the time. The task force's recommendations have been almost universally decried. Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of Health and Human Services, advised women to keep doing what they're doing, as did Susan G. Komen for The Cure and the American Cancer Society. As always, and this hasn't changed, know your personal risk, talk to your doctor, and if he or she won't listen, find someone who will. Stephanie Spielman died last Thursday, leaving her husband and four children heartbroken. The task force and its probabilities be damned. Another breast cancer death is simply one too many.
Renee Seiler is author of Good Enough Mother and produces a video blog under the same name. Our senior producer, Alicia Montgomery, also has her own story. Early detection saved her mom's life. And you can read Alicia's blog on our website at npr.org. Just click on Programs, then Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.